Welcome to Feminist History. Feminism is a word with weight. For some, it equates with solidarity, a sisterhood of sorts, fighting for their rights to be seen and heard as equals in the world. For others, it's a scare word, fraught with connotations of female dominance and synonymous with male oppression. The need for feminism seems to elude many people these days. There are plenty of people who are for equal rights, but refuse to call themselves feminists. Feminism is a word with stigma, but its definition, literally, is the advocacy of women's rights based on the equality of the sexes. Feminism was conceived in response to an idea, that is, the idea that women are inherently inferior to men. Feminism is and always has been a movement about changing minds, and it took a lot of courageous people doing extraordinary things to do just that. Often the most challenging part is just getting women's history the attention that it deserves. According to a 2017 study called Where Are the Women?, the National Women's History Museum determined women are still dramatically underrepresented in United States history textbooks. That means most exposure to women's history is coming from outside the education system, at least for the layperson. Things like podcasts, documentaries, movies, television, and most importantly, journalism. The written word holds immense power. It always has. It has become increasingly apparent that if women's voices and stories are not heard, people make assumptions about their reality, their thoughts, their feelings, their ideals. Journalism and the media continue to hold immense power to sway the people's discussion, and more importantly, their electorate, the vote. In season one of Feminist History, we're taking an intimate look at the lives of women who have wielded their pens to change conversations about the problems in their societies. The theme of season one is women in journalism. Welcome to episode one. We're talking about the life of Nellie Bly. On a chilly morning in January of 1885, a young woman named Elizabeth Cochran picked up a copy of the Pittsburgh Dispatch newspaper. 20-year-old Elizabeth lived with her mother and her siblings in Allegheny City, just outside of Pittsburgh. In between scouring the city for jobs, usually with long hours and little pay, Elizabeth enjoyed reading the columnists that the Dispatch featured. At the time, the Dispatch featured feminist writer and social critic, better known by her pen name, Bessie Bramble. But on that particular day, Elizabeth Cochran opened the newspaper to a column called Quiet Observations, written by a respected Pittsburgh writer named Erasmus Wilson. Now, this column began with a printed letter from a reader seeking advice. Signed only as an anxious father, the correspondent lamented over what to do with his five unmarried daughters, aged between 15 and 26. The Quiet Observer columnist had a lot to say in response to our anxious father and on women in general. Here are a few choice selections from the column that day. Quote, anxious father, thou art in a fix. Thy anxiety is well-founded, if not deeply grounded. Perhaps thou art bald-headed. Thou hast a perfect right to be. Thou art in a fair way to go down to the grave with a weight of care upon thy heart. For advice, get thee to Bessie Bramble. She knows what is what about women. And if anybody can make it appear that thou man, are at fault, she can. Whenever woman is found outside her sphere, whenever she assumes the place of man and makes him her complement, then she is abnormal. A man-woman, that is a woman who ignores her mission, denies her station, and usurps the place of man, is a monstrosity, an abnormality, an abnormal creature. Quiet Observer casually quipped, if nothing could be found to do with the unmarried girls in the United States, then we might soon need to adopt China's policy of murdering girl babies. This column enraged many women in the city, but Elizabeth Cochran sat down and put pen to paper. She voiced her dissent, and she mailed it off to the Dispatch's editor, George Madden. When he received the letter, it was signed only as Lonely Orphan Girl. But Elizabeth attempted to deliver a reality check to the male writers of the Dispatch. Some women had to work, and there was no way around it. Her solution for what to do with unmarried girls was a practical one. Remove barriers that prevent women from getting jobs where they were traditionally excluded. Anticipating resistance, she made her argument well. Quote, "Some people claim it would not do to put woman where she will not be protected. In being a merchant traveler or filling similar positions, a true woman will protect herself anywhere. Well, at least as easily on the road as she would behind the counter, or as easily as a Pullman conductor as she would in an office or a factory. In such positions, receiving men's wages, she would feel independent. She could support herself. No more pinching and starving, no more hard work for little pay. In short, she would be a woman not half as liable to forget what she owed to her true womanhood, as one would pinched by poverty without the means of support. In other words, if we're concerned about a woman's virtue, she would be more apt to protect it if she wasn't being pinched from poverty." The Dispatch editor, George Madden, and our quiet observer, Erasmus Wilson, decided that they had to meet the letter writer orphan girl. They published a small ad asking her to write in with her name and address. But to answer the ad, Elizabeth Cochran just showed up in George Madden's office. Shortly after, he offered her a job as a reporter, and he also assigned her a pen name. That'd be Nellie Bly. Now, the name Nellie Bly's origin is actually from a minstrel song written by Stephen Foster in 1850 while he was living in Pittsburgh.
Nellie Bly, Nellie Bly, bring the broom along. We'll sweep the kitchen clean, my dear, and have a little song.
So no doubt this would have been a very recognizable name for residents of Pittsburgh. The first piece that she wrote under her new name was called Mad Marriages. And it really appears to be a more fully developed continuation of her first piece. She started to figure out her literary style in this piece. It begins with a criticism, of course, of poorly matched marriages, no surprise there, along with vivid imagery of the consequences of such matches. Now, she had plenty of material to pull from. Her own mother had a horrifying experience with her third marriage. Elizabeth Cochran was born in 1864 in a small town called Cochran Mills, Pennsylvania. The town had been named after her father, who was an associate justice for the county. Her early years before the age of six were quite charmed. She had the nickname Pink because her mother liked to dress her up in cute pink dresses and she had a flush in her cheeks. Her family was respected and wealthy. But when she was 6 years old, her father died and he didn't leave a will. And at that point, she got a firsthand lesson in what can happen to a woman who is left without the protection of a wealthy man. Her father had 15 total children, 10 from his first marriage that ended when his wife died, and 5 from the marriage with Elizabeth's mother, Mary Jane. When he died, the 10 eldest came calling for their inheritance. She got her traditional widow's third, but their standard of living decreased dramatically. And unfortunately, 2 years later, Mary Jane made a really bad decision. She married a man named John Jackson Ford. Ford was a drunkard, physically, mentally, and emotionally abusive. He leached off of Mary Jane's pitiful monthly stipend. He threatened her with guns on numerous occasions. After 5 years of putting up with this, she finally filed for divorce. This was a momentous step. This was a very brave thing for her to do. The following quote is from Brooke Croker's biography on Nellie Bly. Quote, "On October 14th, 1878, Mary Jane Kennedy Cummings Ford, in the beady, gossipy, small-town gaze of Olive Hollow, took the momentous step of suing Jack Ford for divorce in the Armstrong County Court of Common Pleas. Amid a total county population of 40,000 people, Mary Jane's was only one of 15 divorce actions that year, one of only 5 in which the wife was the plaintiff. Explained differently, although the number of divorces in Armstrong County doubled in the 1870s against the previous decade, just 84 divorces were granted in that 10-year period." End quote. Young Elizabeth, who was still going by Pink at that time, she testified on her mother's behalf, and this is her testimony. Quote, "My age is 14 years. I live with my mother. I was present when my mother was married to J.J. Ford. I have seen them married about 6 years ago. Ford has been generally drunk since they were married. When drunk, he is very cross and cross when sober. I have heard him scold mother often and heard him use profane language towards her often and call her names, a whore, a bitch. I have seen Mother vexed on account of his swearing and bad names, and I have seen her cry. Ford threatened to do Mother harm. Mother was afraid of him. I've seen Ford throw the clothes after being washed and ironed on the floor and throw water on them, and seen him upset the table. The first time I saw Ford take hold of Mother in an angry manner, he attempted to choke her. This was sometime after they were married. The next time was New Year's night, 1878. She was 14 years old when she testified on her mother's behalf. A mad marriage indeed. So when she was writing her first piece for the Dispatch, she made sure to include some pretty pertinent examples. Quote, "In Pennsylvania, a man or woman, either drunk or sober, as long as they are able to stand up and clasp hands, can be married without one question as to his ability in supporting a wife, as to her ability to make a good wife, or to make home comfortable. It is not asked if they are capable to raise children in the right way. They promise to love, honor, and obey, without one thought of the solemnity of that vow, without one intention of trying to keep it. Poor men without trades, without homes, without $1 laid by for a rainy day, with cruel tempers, brutal instincts, with surprising love for the bottle containing spirits that do not tend to ennoble or better them, had the ceremony performed, and many women similarly situated with hot tempers and shrewd tongues." What can such ill-sorted marriages bring forth? They naturally disagree. End quote. Her writing from the first 2 years of her career is entertaining and fearless, if not a little disorganized, slightly chaotic, and hard to understand. Human interest pieces were her focus, and for her first big exposé, she published a four-part series on the working conditions for women in factories around Pittsburgh. It's clear that these issues were personal to her. The writing feels personal, and that's something to note about Bly. She was not the model of objectivity. At the end of her pieces, you knew very clearly where she stood and how she felt, but that was her style. In fact, that was almost everybody's style in the 1800s. She observed and reported what she saw through her perspective. At the beginning of her career, Nellie Bly's attitude was one of a woman fighting for the right to exist in a world among men. Perhaps kowtowing to pressure from above, editor George Madden started assigning Nellie more stories from the society pages, also known as the women's pages. The women's pages didn't offer the same opportunity to detail the class struggle. Instead, they detailed the latest fashions, homemaking tips and tricks, and other ladylike subjects. Nellie Bly had no intention of being stuffed into that box. So she pitched the idea to her editors to become the Dispatch's foreign correspondent in Mexico. And amazingly, Madden agreed. The assignment was supposed to last 6 months, as she reported on her experiences and impressions with and of Mexico's people. But after only 5 months, she had to flee because she wrote some disparaging comments about the Mexican government. She also inferred Mexico's people were uneducated and savage. Which is something to note. Though she was progressive in her views on women's right to work for equal pay, she was not progressive and not enlightened on issues of race, which is usually indicated by what she doesn't include versus what she does. The Mexican government issued a warrant for her arrest, and she fled back to Pittsburgh. She published a book about her experiences in Mexico a few years later. The months she spent working in Mexico as a foreign correspondent, though, gave her resume a little grit. When she got back to Pittsburgh, once again, they stuck her on the society pages, and she didn't want to do that. So she left. I think her refusal to get stuck on the ladies' pages says a lot about her. She wanted to write about real people. She wanted to highlight the things that she saw happening to people around her. She wanted to be intellectually challenged. I think she saw people were hungry for those kinds of stories. And then, along the way, she realized that she really cared about her career. She wanted to be the best and learned that she didn't want to tie with other women. She wanted to win. And after tiring of the women's pages once again, Nellie Bly decided that she needed a new arena. In early 1887, she left a note for Erasmus Wilson, a.k.a. The Quiet Observer. That note read, "Dear Q.O., I'm off to New York. Look out for me. Bly." And so Nellie Bly took off for New York to carve out a place for herself on Park Street, home of the elite New York newspapers. While trying to break into the newspaper gang, she continued to use her dispatch press credentials to gain FaceTime with the city's major newspaper editors. It was ingenious. She interviewed them on their thoughts about women in the press room. She was no longer just a face in the crowd. She had talked to a lot of these men. But unfortunately, though the Pittsburgh Dispatch published these pieces, the New York newspapermen remained stubborn. Her quest for a permanent job in New York City continued. Late summer 1887, about 4 months after she arrived in New York, Bly was running out of money. She couldn't find a job, but she had a head full of story ideas. She believed she had what it took to make it in that town. So she was so broke, she borrowed a few bucks from her landlady, hailed a hansom cab, and went down to the office of the New York World. The New York World was purchased by media behemoth Joseph Pulitzer in 1883. The World was for the common man and woman. They had a high readership of immigrants and working class people. For her 2005 work, Narrating the News, New Journalism and Literary Genre in Late 19th Century American Newspapers and Fiction, author Karen Rogenkamp pulled the following quote from Pulitzer's first editorial column, and it sums up his vision for the World to a T. Quote, "There is room in this great and growing city for a journal that is not only cheap but bright, not only bright but large, not only large but truly democratic, dedicated to the cause of the people rather than the purse potentates, devoted more to the news of the new than the old world, that will expose all the fraud and sham, fight all the public evils and abuses, that will serve and battle for the people with earnest sincerity." A progressive vision like that would have greatly appealed to a writer like Bly, who was very much of the new world. She was basically the personification of the new woman. This was a term coined in 1894 for women who were no longer held by the same domestic shackles as their mothers and grandmothers. These were women who didn't necessarily have to get married. These were women who went out and got jobs and made a living on their own. And this is exactly who Nellie Bly wanted to be. Nellie Bly pulled up to the office of the New York World. This was a massive 16-story building with a copper dome that housed Joseph Pulitzer's office. It was considered the tallest building in the world for 4 years in the 1890s. I can't imagine how this moment felt for her. This had to feel like her last chance. She didn't even use her own money to get there. But she believed she had what it took. She talked her way past the guards by telling them that she had a story, and if they didn't let her in, she would take that story elsewhere. These were newspaper men. They didn't want to pass on a lead, so she worked her way up to the managing editor's office, and once there, she fired ideas like grapeshot. She wanted to document the immigrant experience from Europe to the U.S. They passed on that one, but the editor had another idea. Rumors had persisted for years about the ill treatment of patients at the infamous asylums on Blackwell Island, right next to Manhattan. If she could get herself committed to the institution and experience it firsthand, and they liked what she wrote, they might give her a full-time job. She heartily agreed. This was her big break, and she knew it. With little guidance and no experience going undercover, Nellie Bly formulated a brilliant setup. She would work her way through the court system and have herself legally committed. She just had to scare the right people. Bly practiced, quote, "looking like a lunatic by making faces in the mirror." After deciding that a slack jaw with a far-off look in her eye made her look especially crazy, she headed to a boarding home for underprivileged women and rented a room for the night under the name Nellie Brown. Then the games began. She played with the minds of the women around her in this boarding house. She used techniques like erratic giggling, far-off staring, irrational speech. In one instance, she described, quote, "I again used my handkerchief to hide a smile, as I thought that before morning, she would at least think she had one crazy person among her flock. Quote, they all look crazy, I asserted again, and I'm afraid of them. There are so many crazy people, and one can never tell what they're going to do. Then there are so many murders committed, and the police never catch the murderers." And I finished with a sob that would have broken up an audience of blasé critics. She gave a sudden and convulsive start, and I knew my first stroke had gone home. It was amusing to see what a remarkably short time it took her to get up from her chair and whispered hurriedly, "I'll come back to talk to you after a while." I knew she would not come back, and she did not. Now, according to Bly, all but one woman in that house refused to room with her, and she didn't sleep a wink. She paced back and forth, muttering to herself. She described this as one of the greatest nights of her life. By morning, the women in the place called the police to take her away. Nellie Brown was taken before a judge who, by her account, treated her with a very gentle countenance and thought that she might be, quote, somebody's darling. I had the thought, I wonder if this man would have treated someone who didn't look like Nellie Bly, who was a short, cute, brown-haired girl with a tiny little waist. And probably not, but regardless, she also managed to convince him that she was crazy, and he sent her to Bellevue Mental Hospital for evaluation. The doctors, of course, found her to be completely insane, and soon 23-year-old Nellie Bly was going through intake at the Women's Lunatic Asylum on Blackwell Island. It should be noted that Nellie dropped the act as soon as she got there. She was no longer acting like a lunatic, no longer acting like she was mentally ill. But unfortunately, she quickly learned that the horrible rumors of ill treatment of patients by staff were true. She described the nurses as abusive, uncaring, and cruel, and the doctors uninterested. Bly's description of the ward's bath ritual was particularly brutal. She described being stripped naked and plunged into a tub filled with ice-cold water. Nurses had positioned one of their patients in the role of sponge wielder, so you got to sit in a tub of frigid water while one of the patients scrubbed your back until it was red. One of the women who had to endure this, Bly said, was already sick, probably from pneumonia, and she died the next morning because they dunked her into freezing water, pulled a sheath over her head, and left her in her cell to shiver throughout the night in the brutally cold ward. After 10 days of this, and numerous attempts by Bly to get reevaluated by the doctors, all of which were denied, Pulitzer finally sent a lawyer to spring her from the place. It turns out it was effortless to get into Blackwell Island, but almost impossible to get out. Bly's two-part story, published under the bylines Behind Asylum Bars and Inside the Madhouse, respectively, were a sensation with the public and prompted the state of New York to allocate more annual funds to assist in caring for the mentally ill. Quote, I am happy to state as a result of my visit to the asylum that the city of New York has appropriated $1 million per annum for the care of the insane. So I have at least the satisfaction of knowing that the poor unfortunates will be the better cared for because of my work. Direct quote from Nellie Bly's 10 Days in a Madhouse, the book she published about her experience shortly thereafter. 10 Days in a Madhouse was a major turning point for Bly. It established her credibility and landed her a full-time job with the New York World. One could argue the world exploited the youth and tenacity and desperation of this young woman, but she absolutely rose to the occasion. Pretty soon, newspapers all over the country had their army of girl stunt reporters who shocked and awed readers by going undercover to investigate the darkest reaches of society to find compelling stories. The stories she wrote after Madhouse were varied, colorful, and wildly popular. She posed as a woman trying to buy a baby from the black market, which was shockingly easy. To investigate corruption in the legislature, she masqueraded as a lobbyist. Quote, I was a lobbyist last week. I went up to Albany to catch a professional briber in the act. I did so. The briber, lobbyist, the boodler whom I caught was Mr. Ed Phelps. He calls himself king of the lobby. I pretended that I wanted to have him help me kill a certain bill. Mr. Phelps was cautious at first and looked carefully into my record. He satisfied himself that I was honest and talked very freely for a king. To be a woman in journalism came with many obstacles, mostly stemming from ignorance and prejudice towards women. Part of what made Nellie Bly so good at investigative journalism is that she used people's prejudices against women to gain their confidence. The assumptions people made about her could be used to fool them. For example, quote, I thought my surest bait for this occasion was assumed innocence and natural ignorance, not entirely assumed, as to how such affairs are conducted. Bly's subjects ran the gamut, and she was always thinking about her next move, seeking out her next big story. Now, in late summer of 1888, Nellie Bly went to her editors with her next big idea. She wanted to travel around the world, just like the fictional character Phileas Fogg from Around the World in 80 Days by Jules Verne. Only she wanted to break that record. She wanted to travel the world in under 80 days. To her great dismay, they said they already thought of that idea, and they were sending a man. Here's a snippet of Nellie Bly's account of the conversation that followed. Quote, he said, "It is impossible for you to do it," was the terrible verdict. "In the first place, you are a woman and you would need a protector. And even if it were possible for you to travel alone, you would need to carry so much baggage that it would detain you in making rapid changes. Besides, you speak nothing but English, so there is no use in talking about it. No one but a man can do this." "Very well," I said angrily. "Start the man, and I'll start the same day for some other newspaper and beat him." "I believe you would," he said slowly. I would not say that this had any influence on their decision, but I do know that before we parted, I was made happy by the promise that if anyone was commissioned to make up the trip, I should be that one. End quote. When the time came in November of 1889, a full year after that conversation, they gave Bly the assignment. It was brilliant on their part because it was naturally sensational. Could a young single woman make it around the world on her own? The New York World intended to find out. They gave her 2 days' notice of when she was supposed to embark on her voyage. Scheduled to depart from Jersey City aboard the ship Augusta Victoria on November 17, 1889, she meticulously detailed her trip preparations, no doubt anticipating questions about how she packed for such an occasion. Quote, "One never knows the capacity of an ordinary hand satchel until dire necessity compels the exercise of all of one's ingenuity to reduce everything to the smallest possible compass. In mine, I was able to pack 2 traveling caps, 3 veils, a pair of slippers, a complete outfit of toilet articles, inkstand, pens, pencils, copy paper, pins, needles, and thread, a dressing gown, a tennis blazer, a small flask and drinking cup, several complete changes of underwear, a liberal supply of handkerchiefs and fresh ruchings, and most bulky and uncompromising of all, a jar of cold cream to keep my face from chapping in the varied climates I should encounter. That jar of cold cream was the bane of my existence. It seemed to take up more room than everything else in the bag and was always getting into just the place that would keep me from closing the satchel. Over my arm, I carried a silk waterproof, the only provision that I made against rainy weather." End quote. The fact that she was a woman was the gimmick. Breaking the record was a side quest. People wanted to know if a single woman traveling alone could handle such a voyage without a chaperone. Newspapers called her, in a cute play on words, quote, "the world's fair traveler." Even better, a competing paper put reporter Elizabeth Bisland on the same assignment, leaving the same day as Nellie Bly, but heading in the opposite direction. The goal was to make it in under 80 days. Nellie Bly traveled nearly 22,000 miles on this trip, through England, France, Africa, to Singapore, to Hong Kong, finally back to San Francisco, where she would board the fastest train in the United States to take her back to Jersey City. She traveled so swiftly that there really wasn't time for her to send back fully developed stories. So she sent short cables to her editors in New York, and the staff writers there kept the public abreast of her progress. The New York World offered an all-expenses-paid vacation to Europe to the person who could guess the exact date and time that she would arrive. So people were hungry for news of her return. Newspaper sales soared. It quickly made the New York World one of the most famous newspapers in the country. As she crossed the North American continent, people turned out in droves to cheer her as she rode the rails to victory. Enthusiastic newspapermen in Pittsburgh sent her a congratulatory flower basket with the following card attached. Quote, "Compliments and congratulations of the Harrisburg Evening Telegraph. You have demonstrated that the American girl is plucky as well as pretty and abundantly able to take care of herself at home or abroad, whether amid snow and ice or beneath the blazing sun of the tropics." The paper also declared if she were to run for president in the next 30 days, she would get an overwhelming vote along the Pennsylvania line. End quote. Per the Evening World, her arrival was to be signaled by the roar of a cannon. Nellie Bly arrived in Jersey City on Saturday, January 25th, 1890. To quote the PBS documentary on Bly, she became a symbol of American pride and power. Her trip around the world had been a triumph, and it had made her internationally famous. It also changed her career in unexpected ways. Everyone knew her face now, and it's hard to go undercover when you're one of the most recognizable reporters in the world. Also, it changed her relationship with the New York world. They didn't offer her a bonus or a pay raise as a result of her achievement that had massively increased the paper's profitability. So, Nellie Bly quit. To her, it looked a lot like Pulitzer and his working editors were reaping all of the rewards of her achievement and not giving her what she truly earned. She left and embarked on a short-lived fiction career with Norman L. Munroe's New York Family Story paper. And that is where we will pick up with part two of the life of Nellie Bly. Thank you so much for listening to episode one of Feminist History. If you enjoyed this episode, it would really help me out if you would go to Apple Podcasts and leave me a review. Please subscribe to Feminist History wherever you listen to podcasts. We are on Instagram and Twitter. Our handle is @fem_history. The short clip of the Stephen Foster song Nellie Bly was performed and recorded by the artist at sheetmusicsinger.com. I want to give a huge shout out to my friend Becky Eagleton Hinshaw. She devoted an entire afternoon to hearing me talk about Nellie Bly and ramble on and on about how interesting I think this person is. And without her, I don't think this episode could have come together so well. Becky is an amazing fiction writer and editor. You can find her most recent work on the Story Discovery podcast by Onyx Publications. She's the very first episode, January 19th, The Audition by Becky Hinshaw. Go check it out and always make sure to rate and review. Folks, thank you so much for tuning into the first episode of Feminist History. I'm your host, Maggie Coomer. See you next week.